The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Specifically contracts, so I'm not going to bore you with more of that now. Professor May is our resident U.S. legal history expert, contract expert, and antitrust law expert. If you like how things have been going in our contracts course for the first few weeks, we've been in class 8 weeks or so, you have Jim to thank for much of that because he served as my contracts teaching mentor since day one of my teaching the course here at WCL. Jim has spent hours and hours with me going through exams, my teaching approach, my teaching notes, my teaching style, my readings, etc., etc. So we owe him a big debt of gratitude. So, without further delay, Professor May.
I haven't done anything yet. Mentoring in the case of Professor Grunwald mostly meant I sat in and said, gee, you're doing a good job with this. Gosh, you're doing a good job with that. So it was a pleasure for me, but the credit goes to Professor Grunwald, not to me. This morning we're going to talk about a really big topic, which is legal theory from after the Civil War on up to middle of the 20th century and beyond, and particularly legal formalism and legal realism. And this is really one of the most important aspects of American legal thinking and activity over the last 100 years. Now, some basic things to say when we talk about formalism and realism is that in the late 19th century was a time of tremendous economic, political, and social change in America. And in this context, there arose a very striking and distinctive general approach. The legal reasoning going too fast over that. And in this setting, there arose a very distinctive general approach to legal reasoning and judicial activity that, as a general approach, dominated the work of the Supreme Court and many other courts until late in the 1930s. And this approach also greatly influenced legal scholarship for decades. And it sparked, for example, the rise of the original enterprise of writing the restatements of law that you have been reading. And this general method left very strong marks on legal doctrine in many fields of law that persist to this day. Okay, this general approach has been given many different names. For example, legal formalism, mechanical jurisprudence, classical legal consciousness, or classical legal thought. And it arose partly in reaction to the tremendous changes associated with the industrialization, urbanization, immigration, and mushrooming economic concentration of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And as a judicial and scholarly response to the increased political agitation and reform legislation of the so-called populist and progressive eras. Okay. Now, this dominant legal approach became intensely controversial, and it generated an outpouring of creative opposition writing by many judges and scholars, starting with such leading figures as Oliver Wendell Holmes, Roscoe Pound, and Louis Brandeis during the Progressive Era. And this opposition writing ultimately blossomed into an outpouring of scholarship in the 1920s, 1930s, that came to be known as legal realism. Now, the clash between formalist and realist thinking became increasingly intense by the 1930s. And ultimately, it resulted in a major confrontation between a more formalist, classical, laissez-faire Supreme Court and the New Deal administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which was memorialized in a great many cartoons, including this one from the time where policeman on the beat, FDR, says to the horse and the buggy, it's actually in this case, it's oxen and buggy, but the phrase was famously at the time, horse and buggy, Supreme Court that obviously is holding up everything the country needs, child labor law, Social Security, a Wagner Labor Relations Act, and the rest. Okay. Well, the battle also sparked an intense controversy within elite legal circles over the fundamental nature of law, local legitimacy, legal legitimacy, and the relationship of law to political power and morality. Now, some of the ideas of both the formalists and the legal realists were ultimately pretty thoroughly discredited. But by no means all were, and to this day we very much continue to grapple in important ways with various ideas, various approaches that were powerfully highlighted, either by formalists or by realists during these decades of debate. Now, you can really enhance your understanding of the way the law develops, the nature of law today, and the particular cases and materials you're reading if you appreciate at least the basic pattern, at least the basic outline of the rise and interplay of formalism and realism from the late 19th century through the middle of the 20th century and beyond. Okay, that having been said, let's start by identifying some really fundamental issues about law that lay at the heart of these controversies over classical legal formalism and legal realism. Okay, so I'm going to start with a really basic question. And the sound you heard was the sound of switching from the lecture to the Socratic mode. Okay? So, really basic question, which seems a kind of fundamental question to be thinking about during a first term in law school, which is, what's the point of having a legal system at all? I mean, other than giving employment to us as lawyers, what's the point of having a legal system? Why do we have one? Why do we need a legal system? See, if there's no real reason, then we really ought to kind of redirect our energy. Yeah.
Disputes are inevitable between people.
Yeah. Yeah. So why don't we just have people work it out amongst themselves, however they want to work it out?
That would,
you know, that's ultimate privatization, right?
It would result in like the anarchy of a full-out like state of war.
Mm-hmm.
Police things so that people aren't just running around enforcing their own contracts with baseball bats and handguns.
Uh-huh. So promotion of violence seems a negative thing. Okay. Any other reason?
Helps us regulate evening.
Uh-huh. How so?
To all the rules that people need to follow.
Okay. And what are the benefits of that?
Everyone's doing the same thing in the same way. It's fair.
Okay. Promote fairness. Okay. Other reasons that it's useful to have a legal system.
Sort of creating a level playing field where both parties are sort of like equals before the judge, as opposed to one side having like much more, I guess, strength, bigger guns, whatever you want to say.
Okay. Okay. Any other benefits?
It establishes a framework in which people can pursue individual rights or rights.
Okay. Allowing the exercise of rights, protecting rights. Protecting rights from whom?
From other individuals with more power, or other individuals that might be acting maliciously.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Back here, all the way.
From the government.
From government? Okay, that might be another reason. So we can think of a lot of different reasons why we might think it's actually good to have a legal system rather than having people just work out their disputes, disagreements, and feelings on their own. Okay. Now, these concerns and goals, of course, can help to justify not just the system of courts, but of government more generally. And once public authority is established, do we care how legislators and executive officials act? And again, this is going to be one of those switch points. And the question is, do we, care whether, for example, people in Congress or state legislature act out of a belief that they're promoting the common good, or alternatively, legislators might think, well, no, we may not be promoting the overall good, but we're promoting the good of some particular group we represent, or we're promoting the benefit of some friends of ours. Should legislators, executives, people in government have unfettered freedom of action to act as they like? One theory might be you still elect people. You've still got a Republican government. You hear out from people what their values are, what their intentions are. You go ahead and elect them. But at that point, you basically trust them. And you basically say, well, okay, there's going to be another election, another 4 years, hopefully. We'll just, in the interim, say you do whatever you think best. Would that be a good approach? Just trust people in government, let them do whatever they want, for whatever reason they want. Does that seem good or bad?
Bad.
No, okay, how many people think that's a great idea? Okay, not so many. Why would it be a problematic idea? Why does that seem a problem? What are we afraid that people would do with unfettered discretion?
Just act selfishly and not take without regard to others and others' needs.
Okay. And certainly as a matter of history, going back a really long time, not just in America but in England, the answer has been no, we don't want to have people in power have unfettered discretion. Not even the king should be above the law. So said Magna Carta in 1215. And prior to the war for American independence, Americans, of course, also very strongly contended that not only the king, but Parliament had limits beyond which it could not go. And even if it might want to tax colonial Americans directly without their consent, the American Revolutionary view was that couldn't do it. There were inherent limits, although that, of course, is a matter of considerable debate in the years leading up to the American Revolution, debate being carried out here in a party way in the Boston Tea Party. Now, today, of course, both the United States and state constitutions establish limits on beyond which legislators and executives cannot go. And the explicit guarantees in these state and United States constitutional documents are not thought to exhaust the limits on governmental power. So that, for example, the Supreme Court, we know, has recognized that people have a right of privacy that government may not ignore, even though this right is not explicitly mentioned anywhere in the U.S. Constitution. Now, it's long been thought in America that courts play a key role in declaring whether or not particular state federal government actions violate constitutional limits. And in the United States, of course, that principle was cemented for the Supreme Court in the early years of the 19th century under Chief Justice John Marshall. Okay, but if we think that there should be limits on actions of legislatures and executives, and that's reflected in constitutional documents and judicial review, the question then became, what about judges? Okay? Should judges be free to decide cases on any basis that makes sense to the individual judge? Okay? For example, if I'm a judge, should I be able to decide for the plaintiff? Because we come from the same town. Or because we belong to the same political party. Or we have the same occupation, or the same ethnicity. Now, if a judicial candidate came to Congress today and said, I'm perfectly happy deciding on any of those things, right? Political party, ethnicity, occupation, hometown, seems to me that any of those are perfectly good bases for deciding a case, okay? What are the odds such a candidate would be confirmed by Congress? That's a zero. Yeah, I think that's probably true. So the idea has been that judges are supposed to be somehow neutral and decide cases on some sort of more principled basis, right? And guided, for example, by applicable precedent, doctrine, and statutes applied to the facts of a particular case. Not just whim, not just personal predilections about plaintiff, defendant, etc. Now, over time, very different perspectives, though, have arisen. Very different perspectives as to how possible it is to keep legal actors acting so that the legal system actually does everything we want it to do. And acts and operates appropriately. So observers have disagreed really dramatically as to how the legal system and legal activity ought to be structured to achieve the ends we've just talked about. And how judges and others in the legal system actually do act has been another source of really intense debate. Okay, so the rise of classical legal thought. Here is the judge, right? Questions of how this judge right here acts. This is the ultimate generic judge here. We know very little about this judge, although the judge has a big gap, we know that. Now, the rise of classical legal thought and the counterattack against it by the so-called legal realists, who condemn classical legal thought as overly abstract, overly rigid, brought those issues really sharply into focus. And this formalist-realist clash generated a decades-long controversy over the proper and actual nature of law in America. That lasted from the late 19th century to the middle of the 20th and beyond, and echoes of that controversy still reverberate quite strongly to this day. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the continuing echoes, the continuing presence of so-called formalist and realist ideas. What is your sense in general as to what people mean, what people are referring to when someone refers to formalism or a more formalist approach to law? What does that connote? More formalist kind of an approach. What does that mean?
Yeah. It's like an emphasis on legal principles.
Uh-huh. Okay. And how would the principles be invoked?
How would they be applied to facts?
Yeah. What would be a formalist way of applying a principle?
I don't know. I mean, just whatever their conception of that principle was, just applying it to the facts at hand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And applying it with facts in hand with a particular result in mind, in what way? Are there other contexts in which we encounter people talking about, well, you're being very formalistic? What is that connote? Yeah.
It's a methodology whereby you can indoctrinate a certain set of principles that seem to be universal.
Okay, thinking of principles as universal. Okay, what else do people seem to mean by formalistic?
It's like formalism, like it's very systematic, very rules oriented.
Mm-hmm. Very much sort of apply things in a kind of, this step kind of logical follower rule kind of thing. Just keep the principle in mind in some sort of neutral manner, unswayed by other concerns, perhaps. Well, if that's a starting general sense of what people often mean, is there any power to that kind of an approach, looking to formal doctrine, formal principle as the rationale for deciding disputes? Is there any power to that today? Now, would a judicial candidate in Congress who said, I don't believe in following established principles, I don't believe in finding what the formal law is and applying it in a straightforward way to the facts of the case, I don't believe in any of that, okay? How would that judicial candidate fare today? What do you think? That's a look for the audible response.
Probably not too well, because we rely on case law precedent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there are other examples, right, where we think that there's some concern about formal doctrine and the straightforward, if there is such a thing, application of formal doctrine. I mean, lawyers don't typically invoke only fairness, morality, and justice without any regard to legal doctrine in actual litigation. Judges instruct juries, right, on what the binding legal rules are that they should take into account. Jurors take an oath, right, that they'll decide a case following the rules of law stated by the judge rather than just by appeals to sympathy or an unstructured sense of justice. And grounds for appeal aren't formulated just on the ground that, well, it just isn't a fair result. I mean, you articulate that there's some incorrect legal decision, right, according to established principles. Now, law school. Okay. Suppose that you take a contract exam, right? And you've got a detailed fact hypothetical. And you look it over, you're real careful about it, and you write the following response. And it turns out you can be able to turn in your blue book or your type answer early. Because all you write is, I think that legal doctrine would be completely irrelevant in the disposition of this case the result would be 100% dependent upon the personality of the judge assigned to the case and her personal sense of fairness. Right? You are done 3 hours and 45 minutes early. Just guess it. If you had to just guess, what grade do you think you'd get? That would say the formal qualities of law are entirely irrelevant. It all ultimately comes down to the basic sense of fairness and justice of whatever judge happens to be assigned to the case. That's the way the world works. Thank you very much. I enjoyed the class. Okay. How many people think they would get an A? Now, I can't speak for Professor Ferrara. I can't speak for Professor Ferrara. I can't speak for any of the instructors. And so I'm only guessing here too, right? But what do you think? Do you think typically on a law school exam you get an A for that kind of response that says formal elements are irrelevant in law? No, probably not. So there seems to be even in law school a notion that the formal element has some importance indeed, and we get a continued prominence of doctrinal formal rule elements in the periodic restating of areas of the law. When the American Law Institute says we think these are the prevailing doctrines, even though the restatement effort itself has evolved in its character over time. Now, on the other hand, is there any power today to the idea that judges' actions sometimes are influenced by more than simply formal rules? Is there any power to that idea today? How many people think that something other than formal doctrine actually sometimes plays a role in how cases are decided? Show of hands. Okay. How many people think that happens a lot? Still a fair number. Okay. So we have sort of formalist as well as realist beliefs that are out there. Now, anybody watch the presidential debate last night? I know you're busy. I know you got assignments. I know. But did anybody get a chance to watch it? Okay, a few people did. Okay. Now, one of the questions, right, last night was, okay, how would you approach nominating people to the Supreme Court? Okay? You both have positions on Roe v. Wade. Would either of you be willing to nominate a candidate that has a position different from yours on Roe v. Wade, and what in general would be your criteria for nominating a Supreme Court justice, okay? They had different answers, okay? For anyone who saw it, which candidate seemed to have the comparatively more formalist approach, and which seemed to have a comparatively less formalist approach, in terms of what we've just been talking about? Yeah?
I mean, McCain is clearly the formalist, whereas Obama is significantly less.
Okay, why do you say that? I think you're right.
Because a formalistic approach to the Constitution doesn't find a right of privacy because it emanates from the penumbras of the Constitution, of the Bill of Rights, actually, whereas a formalist would say that's a load of bullshit, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, I don't think that, I don't know that that word came up in the debate. Like that.
Joe the plumber.
A formalist would say it's not in there. We're looking at the text, and there's nothing in the text or in the intention of the Constitution for it, right?
Okay. And what about Barack Obama's comments are echo more of a realist approach?
He said that he believes that a right to privacy does exist in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, even though it is not explicitly stated.
Okay. And he also seemed to say, I want somebody who has a sensitivity to a sense of justice and fairness that seemed to be something other than simply a good technical reading of the text of the Constitution. So there was some formalism and realism divergence going on even in that debate last night. Okay, now, people today believe in other ways, or express a belief in other ways, that it matters. Something other than formal doctrine matters. They seem to care which judge hears a particular case very often. They often care about the judge's personal views and values in confirmation hearings. And as we just said, at election time, they may care about who's going to be choosing nominees for judicial vacancies. Okay. Now, having said all of this, we turn to examples of formalist or realist thinking in cases that have been already covered this term. And not all of these have been in your class necessarily, because there are many wonderful different case books you can use for example, contracts, and not all of them have the same cases. But I want to talk about the way in which formalist-realist ideas prominently surface in some well-known cases. And for example, there's a great case called Fisher v. Union Trust Company, and here's what it involved. There was a father who was living with a daughter who was mentally challenged and had a great deal of problem living on her own. And he wanted to better provide for her future security. And so what he did one day before Christmas was to say, look, I'm doing two things for you. Here's a deed. I'm transferring title to this land, this property where we live. And there are two mortgages on this property. And so I'm making you my promise that I will pay off these mortgages. And you know how these things work. It never got paid off. And so ultimately there's a suit, not against him because he's died, and it's a suit against the estate and the executor. And the question was, okay, well, is this enforceable in contract law, this promise to pay off the mortgages? And, you know, her argument was, well, of course it is. Of course it is. You know, among other things, at the time, her brother was standing there, and he said, oh, I need to give Dad something, she said. And so she turned to her brother and said, okay, can I have a dollar? She hands her a dollar, and she hands the dollar to the father, right, at the time that he's making the transfer of the deed and making these promises. So she says, okay, obviously garden variety enforceable contract. No, 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 says the court. She loses. Why did she lose? Well, court basically says, look, here's a basic pre-established foundational contract rule, okay? Promises that are a constituent part of a freely willed bargain among private parties will be enforced. Where a promise is given gratuitously, though, by one party, not in exchange for a return promise or performance by the other party, you don't have a bargain. Therefore, enforcement of such a promise is not supported by this above core principle of contract law. And because the record reflects that the father's promise wasn't given in exchange for any real promise or performance, the giving of the dollar was a mere sham, a mere pretense. It wasn't a real exchange. He had said at the time, this will be a great Christmas present for you, which kind of undercut the final bargain. And therefore, there was no bargain. Therefore, principle doesn't justify enforcement of the father's promise. And it doesn't matter, in the court's view, how much the daughter might have been in need of what the father had promised to do. It doesn't matter in the court's view how much the father may have wanted to make a binding agreement. It doesn't matter how sympathetic a person the daughter or other claimants on her father's estate are. And the court doesn't fundamentally re-examine this rule or the bargain requirement in the context of this case. It's simply that the result follows in a straightforward A to B to C to D to E way from identification of the general principle and its straightforward application. Now, the vision of contract law, more generally in classical legal thought, was as reflected in the first restatement of contract in its absolutely central definition of consideration. few things more central to classical contract law than defining what consideration is, right? And it's entirely in terms of a bargain. If you don't have a bargain, you don't have consideration. Okay, that's the approach of the first restatement. Okay, consideration for a promise can be any of these things, but they have to be bargained for and given in exchange for the promise, or there's no consideration. Now, contracts in giving this definition aim to build the entire edifice of contract law on this key foundation. Bargain is the base, okay? And it tried to do this to define the field very sharply distinct from other fields of law. Such as courts, okay? So classical theorists would have loved the symbolic spatial separation of Professor Brona and Professor Vaughan, right? Because there ought to be as wide a separation recognized as possible, right? Between contract and tort. That's right. And later in the 20th century, the two of them get closer together, it turns out. But for now, classical legal thought, that's how it works. Okay, now, by making bargain the central and as nearly as possible the exclusive ground for liability, many other doctrines then were seen to follow, just logically, as extrapolations, okay, as sub-rules under the grand general principle of bargain, right? And this was played out most thoroughly by Samuel Williston, the great contract theorist of the turn of the century, who thought bargain was the key defining element of a contract. Okay, so, and as you know, the bargain definition of consideration persists to this day in the way that the restatement defines consideration as a bargain. Okay, now, while classical contract theory remained supreme, it led courts to deny relief to persons who really suffered harm because somebody else made a promise and they relied on it. But you didn't have a bargain. Sorry. Right? As we've seen, and as I'm sure you've seen, there were cases and materials rejecting or going beyond a purely formalist approach that started appearing early on. Okay? And so, on the one hand, you have the classical approach in Percy v. Curtis, which I think you've encountered, right? Or Prescott v. Jones, that great case where the insurance company writes to someone and says, you're going to need insurance, we'll be happy to cover you, fire insurance for this property, we will go ahead and issue the policy unless we hear from you that you don't want it in the next 2 weeks. He says, well, that's great. He doesn't say anything. He didn't respond. And then you know what happens. The property is destroyed by fire, and the insurance company says, what? We didn't have a bargain. We never heard from the guy, right? He didn't speak up, so too bad, right? And the court said, well, gee, that's too bad. There may be detrimental reliance here, but there's no bargain, and so there's no relief. But, you know, other courts became more and more uncomfortable with that. And there started to be these cases that sort of strained against the formal orthodoxy, right? And so Ricketts v. Scotthorn, right, was a case where the grandfather comes along and says, look, I see you working there, granddaughter, and, you know, if you really love working in this job, that's great, but I don't want you to feel you have to, and so here's my promise for $2,000, no strings attached. You get it if you keep working, you get it if you quit your job, no matter what. Okay, I'm not asking for anything in exchange. Just promise for $2,000, right? There's no bargain. There's no bargain at all, right? And so classical orthodoxy clearly says she's out of luck, even though she gave up her job and the income from that job in reliance on that promise. So what does the court do? Well, you know what they do. They say, the doctrine is that someone can't recover, can't hold somebody to a promise unless it was half of a bargain. In reality, there is no bargain for the grandfather. yet really seems kind of bad that she gave up her job and she's really worse off because she relied on this promise. But yet, in order in contract law for her to have relief, there has to be a bargain. Bad result. No bargain, bad result. No bargain, reliance. What are we going to do? Court says, ah! The only problem is here is that there's no bargain in fact. We can fix that. If we just say because of the reliance, we stop the grandfather's estate from denying the bargain, we just won't let them mention that there's no bargain. We say we're stopped from denying there was a bargain. Does anyone deny there was a bargain? Oh, there's a bargain. Wasn't fulfilled. She gets a normal expectation level recovery. Interesting. Not exactly a straightforward formalist kind of approach. And another example of a case where the formal doctrine seems to lead to a problematic result. Epi McGowan, the human rudder. Webb holds on to the block so that it doesn't hit McGowan in the head, right? There'd be a good bargain if, as Webb is teetering on the edge with that block, McGowan looks up and yells, there's $15 every 2 weeks in it for you if you hold on to that thing so it doesn't hit me in the head, okay? And Webb says, okay, it's a deal, $30 a month, got it. And then goes, right? They have a bargain. Right? And it'd be a nice, straightforward application of doctrine. Trouble is, it didn't happen that way. Problem is, McGowan may have never seen Webb, may have not known anything of the block until, boom, there's the block and Webb. What are you going to do if there's no bargain? Contract law says you need a bargain. Well, let's think about this one. Among other things that the Court of Appeals does is to say, well, look, need a bargain. Ah, okay. The later promise gives rise to a presumption that the service was performed at the request of, at the request of McGowan. Okay, well, if we presume there was a bargain, then there's a bargain. Then there's the recovery. So it's not the only thing going on in the case, but it is one striking part of that case. So there are ways that courts try and strain against existing formal doctrine and its straightforward application, right? And these ultimately get recognized as going on by one of the most famous judges of the 20th century, Judge Cardozo, the High Court of New York in 1927. And in a famous case where a woman has made a promise to give to a colleague, Cardozo says, let's pause here and let's talk about what's going on these days in contract. And he says, look, what's been happening is that there have been a lot of these cases where there's not really any bargain, but somebody's made a promise and somebody has foreseeably relied to their detriment on it, and there are a number of cases where those promises are being enforced even though there's no bargain. And he says, okay, well, how should we react to this? Should we denounce those judges who have allowed that to happen? Should we call for a greater adherence to right-thinking orthodoxy? And he says, no. He says, these are more prominent in the circumstance of promises to give to charity than they are in some other work, but this is just the way contract law is. It's not static. It's not a matter of logic that you figure out one time forever and you just decide every case by just logically working out, okay, how does it apply to these facts? No, no, no. It's an ever-evolving kind of enterprise, right? With differing notions of what's fair, what's right, and even the notion of what consideration means has constantly evolved over centuries, says Cardozo, right? And promissory estoppel, which I think we should now be thinking of it as, is just another iteration. It's just another kind of consideration, just another basis to hold somebody to their promise. And that's fine. That's the way it should be. It's great. We ought to feel really great about it. Now, Cardozo, acting the way Cardozo typically did, having given everybody a sort of education about the nature of law and how it evolves and what's new on the scene and what we ought to embrace, he then says, you don't need to decide the case on that basis. I can find a bargain. And then, as he does in many other cases, Judge Cardozo turns to a very creative application of existing doctrine. You need a bargain? You want an orthodox bargain analysis? No problem. Okay. She never said this was an offer for which she wanted something in exchange, but I think implicitly she was. She wanted her name attached to this. She wanted the college to mention that she'd given money later. So that's like an offer. And I think the college, even though they never said anything, actually accepted that offer. And so I can find an orthodox bargain. So, you know, the other stuff is important, but it actually isn't the basis for this decision. But, you know, good. That's what Cardozo does. Okay? So by the time the first restatement drafting process is going on, under the auspices of Samuel Wolfson as the chief reporter and Arthur Corbin as his differently thinking first assistant, these kinds of more formalist ideas and the reaction to them are starting to gain momentum. And there's a big battle during the restatement drafting process about that core section on defining consideration, right? And Williston and his supporters say, look, the whole field is about bargain. If it's not about bargain, then it's not really part of contracts. Let it go somewhere else. If contract is bargain, right? And Corbin and his supporters, influenced by Cardozo, say, no. Consideration is a continually evolving concept. That's good. It's any sort of basis in law for holding people to a promise, and consideration should be more of an umbrella term. Yes, it includes bargains, but it also includes promissory estoppel, and that would be great. They lost the vote. Williston, et cetera, had the votes. Okay? And so what happens after that? Well, according to Corbin, as told the Grand Gilmore, you know, what happens is the next day, Corbin shows up with this list. He says, okay, fine, we lost the vote. Here's this list of like hundreds of cases where, in what purport to be contracts cases, promises have been enforced where, in any real conventional sense, there's no bargain. What are you going to do about these cases? Okay? And the response is, by Williston, et cetera, is, well, you lost the vote on the definition of consideration, and we're certainly not opening that up again. But you want a little mop-up section dealing with your messy little cases out there? No problem. We haven't used number section 90 yet. Want a section? Fine. We'll give you a section. So, fine. Here you go. A promise which the promisor should reasonably expect to induce action or forbearance of a definite substantial character on the part of the promising which doesn't do such action or forbearance is binding of injustice can be voted only by enforcing the promise. All contract professors in America can say that without one breath. Okay? So that's what it was. Had very few illustrations attached to it, very little commentary as to what it would mean. Ah, but as we know, that would come to loom larger and larger and larger as part of contract law, along with bargain approaches. Okay, now, this idea of openly embracing reliance as a reason to enforce promises in addition to bargain came up prominently in other areas as well, so that it came up in legal realist scholarship as well. Okay, one of the most famous law review articles in or outside of contracts ever was this article by Fuller and Perdue called The Reliance Interest in Contract Damages that very much promoted this idea that contracts shouldn't be seen as just about bargains, but should be seen about protecting, as about protecting reliance on promises as well. Okay, now, how did this full-blown formalist way of thinking called classical legal thought come to dominate? Well, again, this is in the context of a big transformation in American society, economy, politics, from the Civil War to the early 20th century. And this period of Civil War through emancipation, Reconstruction, the new amendments to the Constitution, included the second sentence of the new 14th Amendment, right, which declared that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunity of citizens of the U.S. nor any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process, or deny any person in any jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And that would come to be the source of a tremendous amount of constitutional litigation in the late 19th, early 20th century, at a time when American productivity increased fivefold. We got the rise of concentrated corporate capitalism, harsh new conditions in industrial work, booming immigration and urbanization, dramatically prominent new disparities of wealth, and new protests from farmers and then laborers and progressive era reformers. And all of that would culminate, as we said, by the 1930s in the New Deal. And whoever you are supporting in this year's presidential election, just referring back to the debate again last night, we have reached a memorable point when the conservative Republican candidate charges the Democrat with being too much like Herbert Hoover and not enough like FDR. Not making a point as to who you should support, but it is not something we would have expected some years ago. Now, within this setting, what exactly was classical legal thought? Well, it had two branches, one focusing on private law, one on public law. And the private law branch is what is really associated with the transformation of legal education starting at Harvard Law School under Christopher Columbus Langdell, dean there for 25 years, 1870-1895. Now, Langdell was the one who built a whole curriculum around casebooks and the Socratic method. And you had an extract from his contracts casebook preface, where he articulates what his whole vision is of how to think about law. And what is his core idea as to how to conceive of law? What the methodology is for thinking about law? What do you see law as? That was, the lecture to Socratic term. How should you approach it? Law should be seen as what? Fill in the blank. Law as a what?
Science.
Yes, and that's absolutely key for me, right? Law as a science. And science is very prestigious in American thought in the late 19th century. And the most notable one is physics with Sir Isaac Newton. And yeah, he was looking the other way, but pretty soon he's going to see that falling and come up with the whole theory. But not just the hard sciences, but the appeal of science in social science, particularly economics, with Adam Smith's identification of underlying economic laws. And this notion of trying to find underlying uniformity, underlying principle, is particularly attractive in the social realm at a time of increased social complexity in economy and society. It's also the case that the law schools are increasingly being associated with universities who have undergone their own transformation, and there's a desire to emulate the scientific approach in other parts of universities at the time. Okay? And classical legal thought is also in many ways echoing and paralleling the prominence of classical liberal political thought and economic ideology that posits centrally an idea that there ought to be minimal government whose role centrally is to protect natural rights that individuals have to pursue their own maximum self-interest consistent with the right of everybody else to do the same. Okay. Now, the model of neutral science that is being used is, here's what you do in science. Empirically observe phenomena. Inductively deduce the fundamental underlying principles. Elaborate on those principles to predict future events. How to apply that for law, says Langdell. Observe legal controversies and decisions, particularly appellate decisions. deduce inductively the fundamental principles underlying those decisions, and then elaborate on those principles logically to determine the logically one and only one correct answer in all cases that might arise. General propositions decide concrete cases. Well, the other branch is constitutional law and how to deal with all these changes to expanding state and federal regulation, the development of a body of constitutional law that invokes principles of economic liberty, substantive due process, and freedom of contract. And a good classic early example of the economic liberty part of this is field concurrence opinion that was in the reading that I gave you. Another classic statement of freedom of contract is in the Supreme Court's case of Algar v. Louisiana, which declares that the word liberty in the 14th Amendment doesn't mean just freedom from physical restraint, but it embraces the right of a citizen to be free in the enjoyment of all his or her faculties, to use them in all lawful ways, to live where you want, to earn your livelihood in any lawful way that you want, to enter into any contracts you want, to pursue your own happiness. Now, overall, that becomes a very dominant approach in first the state courts and then the Supreme Court, and there are various scholarly explanations for that that have been offered: political, libertarian, idealism, the influence of economic thought. One classic case exemplifying that view is the famous Lochner opinion, where the court struck down a New York law saying no people in bakeries could be worked by their employer for more than 60 hours a week. And you might think that one way to approach that would be to say, oh, well, okay, this legislation on the one hand infringes somewhat on what contracts people can make. On the other hand, you know, it's really bad for people to be inhaling all of the dust in a bakery and getting what they call white lung disease, so there's some health protection, there's some restriction on contracting freedom, and let's see which balances more. And if there's, you know, a disproportionately interference with contracting freedom, it's invalid. If it's disproportionately health protection, it's valid. But that's not the way that, in fact, the court approached it. It approached it in thinking sort of in binary dichotomy ways to say, well, is this legislation either a legitimate exercise of state police power, 100% total, or is it instead a mere meddlesome interference with freedom of contract? It's one or the other, right? And whichever domain it is in controls the ultimate resolution of the case. Okay, now the selection from Horowitz gives you a sense of these changing overall ways to structure the legal system that were prominent throughout the 19th century, from the writ system to focusing on functional categories like contracts of insurance, contracts of employment, leases. And by the end of the century, this notion among theorists to bring all that together into very broad categories, contracts, courts, property, and to postulate very broad abstract principles that were foundational to the whole thing. Okay? And ultimately, in classical legal thought, you got a whole structure that played beyond the one I just said, which is, okay, in a given case, contracts case between A and B, which controls? The rights of A or the rights of B? Which domain does it fall into? If a state is regulating private action, that's locked. If it's a dispute between state police power and federal government power, which sphere does it fall into? Right? Not a balancing thing. Binary, separate kind of classifications to formally decide cases, with judges having the role of maintaining what were asserted to be non-discretionary, objective boundaries between these various spheres. Okay. Now, this was controversial, and what rose to oppose it was what came first to be known as progressive legal thought or sociological jurisprudence. Okay, this was partly political in its reaction, seeing what kind of legislation was being struck down. And again, people who were strongly associated with this reaction were Oliver Wendell Holmes, Roscoe Pound, Louis Brandeis, and Benjamin Cardozo, a little later. Now, Holmes is the single most important inspiration for the later legal realists, and a great deal of what he said that the realists picked up on can be understood in just three basic principles or outlooks that Holmes articulated. One was, law is not a matter of just playing out on a piece of paper some abstract, detached logic. That's not what law is all about. That's not how it evolves, said Holmes. Life of law has not been logic, it's been experience. That's what shapes it. People's ideas, their prejudices, interest group clashes, all the rich complexity of life shapes law. Second, he says, in 1897, if you want to understand what the law of a state is, you don't start with some abstract general principles and then say, well, logically, then this must be true logically, this must be true logically, this. No, no, no. If you want to really understand what the existing legal system is in a particular state, the person you go to isn't Christopher Columbus Langdon. The person you go to is not a logician. You find a bad man, a bad guy. He doesn't care about logic, but who does care about what's going to get me into trouble. What things will lead me into having to pay damages or potentially going to jail? Predictions of what the courts will do from that point of view will map out the reality of what law is at a given point in time. Prophecies of the courts will do, in fact, nothing more pretentious. Okay. Finally, in Lochner v. New York, Holmes dissented and famously said, general propositions don't, in fact, decide concrete cases. And he also thought there ought to be a great deal of judicial deference to elected legislators. And a court shouldn't decide that the 14th Amendment is violated unless it can be said that a rational and fair man necessarily would admit that the statute would infringe fundamental principles as they have been understood by the traditions of our people and our law. But the three most important are: life of the law has not been logic, it's been experience; prophecies of what the courts will do, in fact, nothing more pretentious or what I mean by law; and general propositions do not decide concrete cases. Okay. Now, despite these critiques, there is continuing power of more formalist thinking in the AOI initial restatement efforts, and indeed, classical legal theory had its heyday in the Supreme Court, not before, but after World War I. The high point of classical legal formalism in the Supreme Court was the 1920s under Chief Justice William Howard Taft. Okay. Well, we said that all of this criticism, all this alternative to classical legal theory came to a head in the legal realists. Okay? And one piece that I had you look at was this piece by Max Radin, Theory of Judicial Decision, or How Judges Think. Okay? And he's dealing with a very simple little scenario, right? And what was going on in that scenario that he dealt with. That was a clue. That was... Okay. Yes, thank you. I got one person who appreciated that. Thank you so much. We're going to go back on that one. Okay. What was the scenario he was talking about, and why is this a clue? Oh, come on. Yes.
Man who owns a jug of alcohol, I guess, hands it to his friend who takes a sip.
That's right. They're sitting on the fence there. And the question is, at a time of prohibition, is the guy who momentarily takes the jug and takes a swig guilty of possessing the liquor? Because drinking alone wouldn't be enough. But is he possessing it? And what Radin says is, you know, there have been these great treatises written about, okay, what does possession mean in law, right? And he says, I suspect that the judge didn't in fact go and read multi-volume treatises on the abstract meaning of possession to decide this case, right? Instead, he says, here's what I think happens in a case like this. How does he think a judge actually operates to decide whether or not the friend on the fence who momentarily took the jug, took a drink, was in possession or not? How does he say a judge probably actually does decide such a case? What might affect that judge's determination as to whether or not violation of law has gone on? Yeah.
I guess whether or not he agrees with like prohibition in general and then works backwards to.
Yeah, and if you sort of want to expand the prohibition, you say, oh yeah, yeah, that was possession. And if you're sort of against it, you want to construe it as narrowly as possible. And then having decided the appropriate result, how do you then write an opinion that supports that result? Is it based on these very learned treatises? No, he says. He says a judge like that is going to be able to find more than one line of cases that arguably is analogous, arguably is a guide for what to do here. And he won't necessarily pick the one that in the abstract is the very closest on point. He'll point to one that is arguably relevant, that helps to support this decision that already has been reached. Well, that's a kind of realist kind of an approach. But legal realism is a term applied to a very large outpouring of scholarship. And one of the famous incidents is a debate that goes on in the law review journals between a much older Roscoe Pound, who is now seen by the younger generation as kind of crotchety, kind of fixed in his ways, not really such a progressive anymore, and who is being challenged by this younger group, such as Carl Llewellyn, who many people came to refer to as the leading realist. And Llewellyn, as part of that debate, gives his own definition of what legal realism is all about, right? He says, legal realists see law as dynamic, not static. They see judges as creative, not just as discovering pre-existing law. Legal realists think law should constantly be reevaluated in terms of its social purposes, its actual social impact, not its abstract logic. Legal realists think there's a constant danger that society is moving rapidly ahead in its economic structure, its social thinking, its various arrangements, and law is stuck in the past. It's not keeping pace. Legal realists think that to really understand the state of law, you don't start with so much, this is the way I think it should be, is it matching up? This is the way I think it should be, is it matching up? You hold that off to the side temporarily to get a better description before you go to your judgment. Legal realists, he says, are skeptical that legal rules accurately describe what courts actually do, the pattern of actual decisions, or that they're even really a dominant influence on how judges decide. And he says, legal realists don't think of law in these grand, broad abstractions like bargain. Think about cases in very narrow, contexts based on the facts. And evaluate legal rules by their social effects and do all these things in a sustained and systematic way. Okay, now, the legal realists are not only building on what these progressive legal thinkers did, but they are being influenced by and they are paralleling larger currents of intellectual thought in the hard sciences, the social sciences, that are definitely taking a more strongly empirical and a more strongly relativistic bent. Whether we're talking about Darwin and evolution, William James and John Dewey as a pragmatic test of what's true, Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis, Thorsten Veblen looking at how organizations actually operate in the economic realm than simply assuming how they do. Bronislaw Malinowski going out and making field studies in anthropology. Ruth Benedict also promoting a cultural relativistic look at human behavior and values. Most famously, Einstein in terms of relativity, that comes to be seen as having much larger implications than just for physics. And the other thing that shakes up people's notion that the world is orderly, that there's one underlying rationality, that it's harmonious, is the Great War, World War I. Now, progressive legal theory and what becomes legal realism is spurred by the actual litigation experience of legal realists, by this outpouring of reported cases that makes them see more and more that it's not all tidy and orderly and all logically held together, and by their notion that there's a strong political cast to the decision by a laissez-faire constitutional court. Centers of legal realism are basically Columbia, Yale, and a now defunct legal research institute that was at Johns Hopkins. And there are various varieties of legal realism attacking a belief that there's a sharp split between the private realm and the public realm. There are a lot of public choices being made as to what entitlements you have in torts or contracts or property law. Notion of law being out of touch with society, notion that we should turn to social science to reform things or just to get a better understanding of how law fits with modern society, legal reasoning more narrowly focused. But then there comes to be a very strong counter-reaction to legal realism itself. Why does that happen? Well, you've got Radin talking about how judges decide, then you've got people like Carl Llewellyn saying things like, what we mean by contract is simply whatever officials do about promises. Now, it's not the logical extrapolation of the fundamental core principle of bargains, which is a good thing in the world because it promotes efficient specialization and maximizes consumer welfare. No. It's just whatever in fact happens. What officials do about disputes is, to my mind, the law itself. Hutchinson, who had been a judge in federal court for 11 years, said, you know how I decide cases? I listen to what everybody says. I go back to my chambers, and I just wait to get a hunch about what's the right result. A hunch. That's the word he used. And then, you know, I'll figure out, myself or the law clerks, you know, how to write the opinion to support that. Jerome Frank said, rules and precedents have only minimal influence on judicial decisions. The continued belief to the contrary is just that people lose faith in their father. They want some infallible source out there in the world to have security. They transfer that on to judges. Okay? Thurman Arnold says, abstract theories and moral principles are simply mythical. They're just emotionally satisfying symbols. Hessel Intima says, the ideal of a government of laws and not of men is a dream. Wait, say people like Roscoe Pound or the young president of the University of Chicago, Robert Maynard Hutchins, or the philosopher Mortimer Adler, or people like Thomas Mann, Louis Mumford, Reinhold Niebuhr, or Walter Lippmann, and particularly Catholic legal scholars at Catholic and Georgetown. They say, wait, you have gone down the road of now saying that there are no underlying realities. There are no moral principles that stand aside from the whim of an individual judge. There's nothing out there. There's no possibility of a government of law and not of men. There's nothing there. And you know what happens? If you go that far down the road, they say, literally, you go down that road and you start with Oliver Wendell Holmes, where do you end up? With Adolf Hitler. And they're not kidding. This is in the ABA Journal, okay, 1945, an article called Hobbes, Holmes, and Hitler, and it goes back and forth. And their notion is, if you have no basis to say that what Nazis are doing, because they happen to be in power, has no less the dignity of law than what people in America in power are doing, because your definition of law is just what people in power do, how do we have a basis here now? In the 1930s, at a time of Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini, how do we have a basis to condemn morally what we think is reprehensible? Right? And so that is a large part of what the counterattack is, to which the legal realists in large part sort of say, well, we're not really backing off, but we hate Nazis as much as you do. And it's not really resolved in the mid-1940s, and it paves the way for what comes to be known as the post-realist dilemma in American legal thought. But we're out of time, so I can't tell you what happened.